ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Annabelle Quince with a Rear Vision Extra. This week, a look at the history of a conflict we've all ignored for too long, the war in Sudan. It's a story that has long roots, which is why we are rerunning a program from 2011 that traces the story from the early 1800s when Sudan was conquered and colonised by Egypt, who was then part of the Ottoman Empire, through to independence and the events that led to the separation of South Sudan. Part 2, which will be on ABC Radio National on Sunday at noon, or on your ABC Listen app, explores how that long history and the current geopolitics of the region are shaping the current conflict in Sudan. I hope you enjoy these two programs and that they give you, as they did me, a better understanding of Sudan and why the current conflict matters.
During the decades of fighting in Sudan, millions of southerners fled north to escape the fighting.
The south feels it has been exploited for many decades. More than 2 million people died in two civil wars.
After a 50-year wait, one of the poorest regions in the world is finally going to get a say on independence.
With all but a tiny fraction of votes now counted in the South Sudanese referendum, nearly 99% of the population have voted for the South to become an independent country.
Earlier this month, the people of southern Sudan voted in a referendum to decide whether or not to remain part of the Sudan or to separate and become an independent nation. The official results will not be declared until next month, but it's clear that an overwhelming majority of southerners have voted for independence. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and via the web. In today's program, we trace the history of the Sudan and explore why it is that the people in the south of Sudan are so determined to separate from the north. Gerard Prunier is a historian specialising in Central and East African affairs.
Sudan is the largest country on the African continent. It's a bit over 2 million square kilometres. Southern Sudan is 750,000 square kilometres. That is roughly a third of the surface of the whole. There are no basic geographical differences between the north and the south. I mean, most of the country, I would say 80% of it, is a flat pancake. This is not a land of big jungles, you know, no Tarzans lurking in the bush. It's mostly dry scrubland.
And culturally, can you explain the historical differences between the people in the north and the people in the south?
They're completely different. The northerners are people of mixed blood, with the core is Cushitic, that is, these people are cousins of the Somali and the Abyssinians, with light admixture of black blood from the south and Arab blood from the north, although the core is neither. But culturally, they call themselves Arabs for the simple reason that they speak Arabic as a mother tongue, so you could say that they're cultural Arabs. But that goes only for about one-third of the population, those who live in the center, northern part of the center of the country. The eastern part is very much like Abyssinia, and in the west, in Darfur, half the population is not Arab, not even culturally. They are black Africans who speak a variety of languages, although most of them have been Arabized, so they speak Arabic as a second language. In the south, there is no Arabization at all. The whole north is Muslim. The south has only about 5 to 7% Muslims, and these are usually former soldiers. It is now largely Christian. Before the coming of the British, it was animist with traditional tribal religions, and they got progressively Christianized during the British period.
Islam was introduced into northern Sudan via Egypt, and by the time the Ottoman Empire conquered the Sudan at the beginning of the 19th century, most northerners were Muslim. Historian Martin Daly is the author of Civil War in the Sudan and A History of the Sudan.
The Sudan was invaded in the 1820s by Muhammad Ali Pasha, the Ottoman governor of Egypt. Between 1821 and the 1870s, the control of the Turco-Egyptian regime, which is what the Egyptian rule in the Sudan is often called, extended southward, eastward, and westward until by, we can say, the late 1870s, it covered just about all of what we call today the northern Sudan, and indeed bits of Eritrea and Ethiopia beyond Sudan, and certainly laid claim to just about all of what we call today the southern Sudan, although actual administration in the south, and indeed most of the north, was minimal.
According to Ibrahim Anua, Associate Professor of Political Science at the American University in Cairo, slavery was the main point of contact between the North and the South during the Ottoman period.
I wouldn't say that there's much of connection. During the Turkish Sudan, that is 1820 until the Mahdist Revolution in 1885, the prevalence of the slave trade and many of the slave traders were from the north. So this was very unhappy part of the history of southern Sudan and northern Sudan relation.
This was a reservoir for slaves. The south was looted for men and women, but mostly men, to be taken into slavery to northern Sudan, to Egypt, all over the Middle East as far away as Turkey.
And how did the British come to rule Sudan?
By chance, by mistake. Basically, it's because Sudan had been colonized by the Turco-Egyptians, or perhaps I should use the proper word, Ottomans. Of course, the British came simply because they took over Egypt.
Well, the British arrived to stay starting in 1896, but in the 1880s, there was a local religiously inspired revolutionary movement, the movement of the Sudanese Mahdi, who, with his followers between 1881 and 1885, threw out the Egyptian regime we were just discussing and replaced it with his own theocratic state. The Egyptians, of course, resisted that expulsion, and part of that era of resistance in the mid-1880s involved the famous British General Gordon, who was sent to Khartoum ostensibly to help evacuate the Egyptians from the country, but once he got there, refused to leave and held out in Khartoum against the siege of the Mahdists. And finally, in January 1885, Khartoum fell to the Mahdi's army. Gordon was killed, and the rest of the country within the next few months was evacuated by the Egyptians. But the British controlled Egypt at the time, and so a great deal of pressure was brought to bear on them, both within Egypt, but also in Britain, by imperialists, by missionaries, by people who wanted to avenge General Gordon and others, certainly also by people worried about other European powers gaining a foothold on the Upper Nile and threatening Britain's position in Egypt. After a great deal of diplomatic and military activity, in 1896, for reasons really directly unconnected with the Sudan, the British advanced up the Nile from Egypt, beginning a campaign that ended in September 1898 with the Battle of Omdurman, when the Mahdist forces were overwhelmed and the British then and thereafter occupied the country. They didn't want to take direct control of the country because they didn't want the expense of running it. They covered their colonial control of Sudan with an instrument, they called it themselves a hybrid form of government called the Anglo-Egyptian Condominium. In other words, a joint sovereignty with Egypt, through which, however, the British called all the shots until 1956 when independence came.
And how did they rule the North and the South? Did they try and integrate the two sections of Sudan?
No, they didn't. They didn't for a whole variety of reasons. First, because the Southerners had no sympathy for the North and did not look towards any form of integration with pleasure. So the colonial power, which was very light on the ground, they didn't have all that many men to rule the Sudan, going against the feelings of the Southerners would have been a little difficult. Also, there was a kind of Christian prejudice. Since already the Southerners, those who had been conquered, were converting to Christianity, there was a certain amount of sympathy on the part of the British towards these new Christians. And then there was the memory of the slave trade. So the dislike of the Southerners to be ruled as and together with Northerners had obvious reasons. So eventually the British had what they called the closed districts, and the whole of southern Sudan was ruled on a different basis from the north, almost as a separate colony.
What was it like in Sudan during the colonial period? And did the British tend to favour or develop the north more than the south?
Yeah, definitely, because their main interest was in developing cotton production, and therefore the most suitable place for cotton production was central Sudan. So you had all the infrastructure. The railway was built from the north to conquer Sudan, and then it was built towards the Red Sea to export cotton. And so you have all the infrastructure being concentrated there. Not only the infrastructure, but actually the education system. But yes, all the development efforts were taking place in the north.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're taking a look at the relationship between the north and the south of the Sudan. Independence became an issue in the 1940s, and Britain had to make a decision whether to keep the north and south separate or to join them together into one independent nation.
In the 1940s, when the whole issue of independence seemed suddenly to be coming to the forefront at the end of the Second World War, the British had to make some decision along these lines. And British administrators in the South strongly favored a separate course for the South. That isn't to say they argued for separate colonial status, but at least for what they called safeguards for the Southerners in any political arrangements that were made for the Sudan as a whole. This didn't work. The British, and by British, I mean now, the British government in London was far more concerned with Egypt, the security of imperial communications through Suez, and therefore with placating the northern Sudanese, who were allies of the Egyptians in all of this. And that meant that they could not, or at least would not, take the steps that might have been necessary to put in place such safeguards for Southerners. So at independence, many Southerners, many of the educated elite in the South, I should say, saw themselves as somewhat abandoned by the British to their northern, more sophisticated, more developed, and in any case now powerful northern compatriots.
So what happens at the point of independence between the North and the South, especially when there was clearly that level of tension?
Immediate revolt. Actually, the revolt of the black elements, the black troops in the Sudan Defense Force, mutinied against their Arab officers and killed them immediately in August 1955, that is 6 months before the date of the formal independence. And they actually immediately radioed the British in Khartoum, and they said, come back. You know, we don't want independence, and we don't want those Arabs. Actually, we just killed them. Why don't you come back and stay? And the British said, yes, yes, yes. They sent Royal Air Force planes full of Arab troops. The Southerners were miserably betrayed by London, which had made a decision to give independence to the Sudan as one unit so as to please the Egyptians and stay in the Suez Canal zone.
That itself is somewhat controversial. In 1955, that is a few months before independence, a mutiny broke out in the South of Southern soldiers. There were several immediate reasons for this, but during and after the mutiny, hundreds of Northern Sudanese resident in the South were killed. The northern government in Khartoum then, with British help, was able to restore order, and independence went ahead on the 1st of January 1956. Many of the mutineers in the south were tried, convicted, and executed. Many others, the majority, escaped, though into the bush and indeed over the borders into neighboring countries. Now, some historians, or many, most historians rather, have said that this was the beginning of the Civil War, but recent research has pretty well exploded that idea and shown that between 1955 and the early 60s, there was a period of no peace, no war, during which, however, the northern Sudanese government feared a new mutiny, or for that matter, an insurrection, and took various hard steps that created the situation that gave rise to the outbreak of civil war in the early 60s. In other words, repressive political measures that and restrictions on the use of English, restrictions on the missionaries, which led eventually to all of them being expelled, restriction on religious practice that educated Southerners saw as proving that their future in the Sudan was going to be that of second-class citizens at best, or at worst, that they would become victims of a policy of assimilation by the northern government. And that probably is what led to the outbreak of the Civil War in the early 60s.
And what was the impact of that war? How long did it last, and what impact did it have on Sudan?
The effect on the region itself, of course, was devastating. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Many hundreds of thousands left the country as refugees, some of them never to return. The development of the South was not only further delayed, but set back because much of the rudimentary infrastructure that had been created was destroyed. A whole generation of Southerners went without education. And so the effect was disastrous.
Since independence, the Sudan has suffered from political instability. In 1958, Parliament was overthrown in a military coup. In 1964, the army was forced to relinquish power, and between 1966 and 1968, there was a series of civilian governments. Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Windsor in Canada, Abdul Salam Sid Ahmed, argues that it was during this short period of civilian rule that the first real attempts to end the civil war began.
The first military regime was overthrown by a popular uprising in 1964 that brought in civilian government. They organized a conference called the Roundtable Conference, to which all the political forces from the north and the south were invited. But one of the issues that led to the failure of the conference is that nobody could speak on behalf of the rebel group, the armed opposition group at the time. They were not represented directly, and none of the political leaders from the south could speak on their behalf. This situation continued until another military regime came to power in 1969, and again it made a declaration about solving the problem of the south. At this time, it was successful, actually. One of the problems that characterized the first civil war was that there was not a unified political and military leadership. There was a lot of divisions among the southern leaders that made the political settlement also difficult. But in the early 70s, most of the political and military leadership became unified under one leader called Joseph Lago. And this is the group that entered into negotiations in the early 70s. And so there was an agreement that was concluded in 1972 that was known as Addis Ababa Agreement, and it gave the South regional autonomy.
Well, the war ended formally in 1972 with the Addis Ababa Agreement that created a separate regional government for the southern Sudan within the unified Sudanese state. A southern regional government with its own legislature and its own council of ministers and president, or president of the region, not of the country. The brief interwar period from 72 until the outbreak of the Second War in 83 witnessed some progress and political and economic development in the south, but by and large, this was starved by the northern regime of President Nimeiri, the dictator who had taken power in the north in 1969 and indeed helped to engineer, ironically, the Addis Ababa arrangements. For reasons of northern politics, he clawed back many of the concessions that had been made to the south. And by 1983, to make a complicated story simpler, a new insurrection broke out led by the Sudan People's Liberation Movement.
What President Nimeiri did, the same ruler who engineered and agreed to the peace agreement in 1973, tried to dishonor what was agreed upon, but also ultimately Nimeiri fall into the trap of political Islam, declaring Sharia laws in the north. So this imposition of political Islam and the dictatorship in the north trying to reproduce itself in the south triggered the Second War.
So what did that mean for you as a northerner teaching in the south?
It was very unfortunate because I could see that the 1973 agreement could have really contributed a lot to the development in the south, but it was completely disrupted by war.
The irony was that the man who became the leader of the rebellion was a man who was very much trusted by the dictator, Jafar al-Nimeiri. He was a colonel in the Sudanese army by the name of John Garang, and he was a professor at the military academy in Khartoum. And when there was a mutiny of southern troops in the south, Nimeiri called him and he said, why don't you go to the south and quiet these boys down? Tell them that everything's all right, they shouldn't rebel. And Garang, who had been in contact with some of the conspirators of the mutiny of the 105th Battalion, didn't really know what to do. But when he went to the south, he asked around, he asked people and he said, what do you think? And everybody told him the war is unavoidable, Colonel. So either you are with the Arabs or you join them. So he decided to join the mutineers. And since he was very educated, he had a PhD from the United States, you know, he was welcomed by the rebels, who were mostly rather poorly educated black army officers. And they said, by all means, if you want to be our leader, please go ahead. We'll follow you. So he became the leader.
Well, the first civil war was ostensibly for independence. This, of course, never came close to taking place, and the Addis Ababa Agreement was a series of concessions by the northern government to keep the country together. The Second Civil War, though, was fought at least initially and by terms of the movement's own manifesto, not to separate the South from the North, but to revolutionize the whole country. John Garang, the longtime leader of the movement, insisted that his object was not to separate from the Sudan, but to create a new Sudan that would extend the benefits of citizenship to all of those peripheral groups of the country, north, south, east, and west, who had been left out of the power equation in Khartoum.
The impact of the war was rather spectacular, because Garang was a very clever man. He knew that he could use the Cold War to his benefit. So he took all the rebels and they walked all the way to Ethiopia, which was then a communist country. And he asked the support of the Ethiopians and the Russians. And it worked perfectly. So immediately he had enormous amounts of weapons and diplomatic support and money, and the war exploded with extreme violence. It was a big episode of the Cold War. The battles were quite intense. The rebels had anti-aircraft missiles. They shot down practically the whole Sudanese Air Force, and this was a very serious war.
As we approached Yei, we came upon a row of skulls scattered over a kilometre. All that remains of an entire government garrison ambushed as they retreated from the town last April. When we arrived at Yei, we found the hospital was filled with wounded civilians. These people are the innocent victims of the Sudanese government's vengeance for its military setbacks.
Why the war went on for so long is complicated, of course. It has to do with regional politics, that is, the involvement of neighboring states, the waxing and waning of one side or the other's political and military power in the field, changes of government in the North. It looked like the war might end, for instance, in the 1980s, 1989 to be exact, when the then democratic government of Sadiq al-Mahdi was overthrown by elements in the army and their allies in the Islamist movement because they frankly objected to the deal that looked set to be worked out between the politicians and the Southerners. And a whole new phase of the war began then.
Between 93, 94, 95, roughly in those years, it looked like the Northern regime was going to win. And at the time, there had been a coup in Khartoum in 1989, and the Muslim Brothers had taken power, so you had a radical Muslim regime that was even more gung-ho and more aggressive than anything before, and they came very close to winning militarily.
At stake, of course, ultimately, was the future of the country. The Northern Sudanese parties, but especially the Islamist National Congress Party that runs the government now, were never willing to extend full rights of citizenship to Southerners. They insisted on an Islamic constitution that would privilege Muslims, and Southerners wouldn't buy it.
There was a big turning point in 94, which was the end of apartheid in South Africa, because a lot of weapons had been stockpiled for war, civil war in South Africa. And when Mandela came out of jail, Mugabe called an emergency meeting where he was present, and so was President Nyerere of Tanzania. These are things that are not yet part of the commonly known history. And, of course, Mandela. And he said, now, these weapons will never be used for war in South Africa. The man who needs them most on this continent is our friend John Garang in the Sudan. And so Garang, who had been starved of military supplies by the collapse of communism, suddenly found a tremendous boost when all these stockpiles of weapons were transferred from Tanzania, where they had been stored, to him. And the second point was Mandela being freed and communism having collapsed. Garang was somehow washed of the sin of having been a communist. So slowly he was able to re-ingratiate himself with the Americans and get support from the U.S. And in the early 2000, President Bush was hard-pressed by the Christian right, and they took to heart the Sudanese cause, and they told Bush, we must push for peace in the Sudan. So Bush leaned on Garang and said, now we have to have peace.
After more than two decades of conflict, the Sudanese government has signed a peace deal with the Sudan People's Liberation Army.
At a ceremony in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, former enemies signed an agreement to cease the hostilities, which have claimed 2 million lives.
Only with the agreement worked out in the early part of the last decade was the prospect of self-determination brought to the table and agreed upon, and it's that concession by the North that has brought us to where we are today. First an agreement in 2005, and now the referendum that's taking place this week.
By casting their ballot, they are almost certainly marking the moment South Sudan becomes independent, the point at which they create the new state that they've been fighting for on and off for more than half a century. And so, calmly and with dignity, South Sudan is about to go it alone.
And how do you feel personally as a Sudanese person who comes from the North Sudan at the idea of the country that you knew being split into two?
I feel very sad. I'm not any Northerner. I'm a Northerner who educated Southerners for two decades. So I knew the South. I knew the South and I enjoyed living there. I enjoyed interacting with the Southerners, and I feel I'm losing an important part of my life. Many of the Northerners are feeling very sad. Of course, we have to be objective. This is the right because of so many mistakes made by the ruling elites in the North. We are paying for historical mistakes.
Ibrahim Anyua, Associate Professor in Political Science at the American University in Cairo. Our other guests, Sudanese historian Martin Daly, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Windsor, Abdul Salam Sid Ahmed, and Gerard Prunier. Today's sound engineer is Judy Rapley. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.